The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Former NSA Director John Bolton releases his book, The Room Where It Happened.
I've also seen instances where there's information that I am confident was classified.
And what is the nature of the Chinese Communist Party, and what are we dealing with across the globe?
The Chinese Communist Party is the only ruling Communist Party that has never officially broken with Stalinism.
The mayhem which characterized the last several weeks seems to have quieted, but no statue seems safe from defacing or toppling.
When you're tearing down statues of U.S. Grant, it's not because of the Civil War, it's because you hate America.
And race in America is front and center. But when will the proponents of eugenics of years gone by face an accounting?
Well, the issue before the court was whether sex in that law includes sexual orientation and gender identity or not.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at hughhewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me at Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. We have seen a lot of comings and goings in the West Wing during President Trump's years. National Security Advisor John Bolton's departure arguably was one of the biggest noisemakers of the entire administration. And the noise hasn't diminished. A week ago, John Bolton's new book, The Room Where It Happened, dropped despite an effort by the administration to stop its publication that was turned back by a judge. Federal Judge Royce Lambert refused to put a stop order on the book, despite his finding that, quote, the court is persuaded that defendant Bolton likely jeopardized national security. The horse was clearly out of the barn by then, and the judge said the damage was irreparable. Shortly after the ruling, I spoke with a guest who's in a position to know the extent of the potential damage. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was a guest on my program. I had never expected to say this because John Bolton is a friend of mine. He's been on the show many, many times. He was generous with his time to me as well when he was National Security Advisor. But I'm shocked, not by his book, I haven't read it, but by what Judge Royce Lambert wrote in his ruling about the book. The judge concluded, quote, the court is persuaded that defendant Bolton likely jeopardized national security by disclosing classified information in violation of his nondisclosure agreement obligations. Bolton may indeed have caused the country irreparable harm. With hundreds of thousands of copies around the globe, many in newsrooms, the damage is done. There is no restoring the status quo. So the injunction was denied because the judge basically said there's nothing we can do about it. But jeopardized national security. How much damage did this book do, Mr. Pompeo?
So, Hugh, I haven't had a chance to read the book either. I've seen a number of the excerpts have been put out. I'd say three things about it, first of all. First, a number of things I've seen. I was in the room, too. I was present for those. I remember them very differently. These are things that have been either fully spun or frankly, just lies that don't reflect what truly happened there. Second, you know, the book says he was in the room. The truth is he was such a difficult person and leaked so much information even while he was still in office that it was often the case that he wasn't a participant in the meetings because we all had come to see that there was real risk that this information would end up in places it shouldn't have. And then finally, to your larger point, I think Judge Lambert has it right. This is unprecedented, what John Bolton chose to do while a current president is still in office, to have his most senior national security staff member write a book containing detailed asserted quotations about what was said to foreign leaders, what was said in very private meetings on sensitive topics, presents enormous risk. I've also seen instances where there's information that I am confident was classified, and I am saddened because this is a horrible precedent, and I hope I'll leave to Attorney General Barr to make the final decision. But as I stare at that, This is the kind of thing that we've seen happen. I was a soldier once. You know that story. I saw young soldiers who were prosecuted for releasing classified information at a much lower level, who were much more junior, and who didn't have 30 years of experience handling classified information. This is something that has real criminal risk associated with it, and for the life of me, I can't figure out how it's the case that this can be permitted to stand without a real response. If this becomes the pattern and practice, this is truly damaging to American national security.
Is the NSA finally working in hand in glove with you and with the president?
We have a functional process that is aimed at executing a interagency coordinating function to deliver good option sets, fact-based, data-driven option sets for the president of the United States. It's how it's supposed to work. It's how it's happened in Republican administrations that have been very successful. The good news is that in spite of those challenges, I could tick through a list of enormous foreign policy accomplishments. When John Bolton says that the president's decisions were based solely or nearly solely on his aim to get reelected, that's not what I have remotely observed. When the president made the decision, difficult decision, to go after Qasem Soleimani, it wasn't about getting reelected. When he went after Hamza bin Laden or Baghdadi or Qasem al-Rimi, when we work on religious freedom all across the world, the pro-life policies that we've put in place all across the world, those aren't about getting reelected. Those are trying to deliver the fundamental role of the United States, protecting Americans, keeping Americans safe, and President Trump has delivered that.
Following the initial attention surrounding the establishment of the CHOP zone in Seattle, things seem to quiet down, but only for a nanosecond. CHOP is still there, though Seattle's mayor, Jenny Durkin, has said they will be reestablishing order. But CHOP has become just one more example of chaos as the nation watches scene after scene of destruction, defacement, and removal of statues, some of heroes, some of rogues, and of monuments like the Lincoln Memorial defaced across the country. I was outraged when I myself spoke with United States Senator Tom Cotton. There was an attempt to destroy the statue of Andrew Jackson in Lafayette Park. It was not successful. You are of the opinion, I believe, that those demonstrators turned rioters should be prosecuted. Am I correct?
Lock them up, Hugh. First off, yeah, they're not protesters. They're not demonstrators. And they're trying to tear down a 168-year-old statue. You can call them vandals. You can call them criminals. You can call them vigilantes. But soon enough, they should be called inmates. Hugh, there's a law from 2003 called the Veterans Memorial Preservation Act. You couldn't find a much more clear-cut case of a violation of that law than what happened last night, tearing down a statue of a former general of our Army in uniform, on horseback, on federal property. The violation of that carries up to 10 years in prison. I would urge Attorney General Barr to direct the FBI and the Criminal Division to investigate this immediately, arrest as quickly as possible, and bring charges as quickly as possible.
Would that apply to the toppling of Ulysses S. Grant in San Francisco as well? Who, by the way, the irony of that is should not be lost on anyone.
When you're tearing down statues of U.S. Grant, it's not because of the Civil War. It's because you hate America. Now, in San Francisco, I don't know if the statue that was torn down was on federal property or if it was federal property. Another law that might apply is the Anti-Riot Act. There's other potential federal laws as well. Unfortunately, local authorities should be prosecuting these cases. They should be stopping the violence in the first place, but many of them seem simply unwilling to stand up to the mob.
All right, now I want to switch quickly to Twitter. You were threatened by a, quote, low-level staffer at Twitter last week with the suspension of your account. Have you heard from Jack Dorsey or anyone in senior management that such attempted censorship will not occur again? And it's not unconstitutional censorship. They're a private company, but it is clearly censorship of viewpoints they do not agree with.
Yes, Hugh, I must admit, miss Jack Dorsey's DM to my Twitter account. Of course, you could put him in the boat with the snowflakes at the New York Times because it's been reported that he unfollowed the New York Times opinion Twitter account after they published my op-ed a few weeks ago that turned them into a laughingstock. But it is true that in the midst of that controversy, a low-level employee contacted my office at random and said, if the senator doesn't delete his tweets, we will permanently lock his account. It was clear, though, she was acting at the behest of more senior officials who she tried to screen and that she wouldn't put anything in writing. Now, we stood up to her. We drew a line. We sent her the reasons why this was a gross violation of their own terms and their own policies. We continue to get shifting explanations, but the 30-minute deadline came and went, and after a couple hours, she called us back and said, we'll take no action against your account, although she said that she also wasn't authorized to say anything more. So it's clear that she was acting at the behest of senior censors at Twitter, but it's just an example of the challenges that conservatives face on Twitter or on social media more broadly. Look, I'm a United States senator. You can't really deplatform a senator. I can always go to the Senate floor. I can go to other medium. But what if it was just a conservative journalist or a Republican Party activist? How could they stand up? This is why I've introduced legislation along with Senators Hawley, Rubio, and Braun to modify Section 230 to strip away some of that unprecedented legal immunity that social media companies get, because they are increasingly acting as publishers, acting as censors, taking responsibility for the content that is posted and is not posted on their site. If that's the case, they don't deserve that immunity.
Related to all of this, there's a move underway to change the name of military bases around the U.S., some of which were named for Confederate generals, a move with which I wholeheartedly agree. I spoke with U.S. Senator Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee, who serves on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Now, Senator, I want to move to a very controversial subject, which luckily you have no investment in, which is the naming of our military installations. Yesterday in Virginia, I drove by Fort A.P. Hill. It had never occurred to me, because I'd never known the sign. I hadn't seen the sign that we had a major military base named for a Confederate general. He broke his oath to the Union and fought against the Union. And that Fort Hood is the same way. In fact, I have no investment whatsoever. I want to change all of these bases' names because I'm a Union man and my family was a Union family. We're from Ohio. You're a border state that stayed in the Union. What do you make of this issue? And should President Trump act, and should the Republicans act, to rename these military bases?
We have decided at the Senate Armed Services Committee that there will be a commission that will look at these over a 3-year period of time. I think that one of the things we have to be careful about is not trying to erase our nation's history, but learning from our nation's history. And one of the things that we do know is many of these bases, they are named for these Confederate generals. And if we decide, and if the communities decide to rename them, I think that that is an appropriate thing to do. And, you know, Hugh, I think it is also appropriate to remember it is the Republican Party that fought against all of this with the Civil War and has fought repeatedly to end oppression and has fought repeatedly to make certain that under our Constitution, equal means equal. It means everyone.
Coming up,
the Chinese Communist Party is the only ruling Communist Party that has never officially broken with Stalinism.
The new National Security Advisor, the one who replaced John Bolton, Robert O'Brien, joins me. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. What is the nature of the Chinese Communist Party? Ambassador Robert O'Brien is the new national security, the right arm of Donald Trump on matters international and national security related inside the West Wing, working closely with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. You gave a speech in Arizona comparing General Secretary Xi of the Chinese Communist Party to Joseph Stalin. What did you intend to provoke out of China by doing that?
Well, the comparison I made is between the Chinese Communist Party and the former Soviet Communist Party, and the point I made is one that's been made by academics, and that is that the Chinese Communist Party is the only ruling Communist Party that has never officially broken with Stalinism. So it's a Marxist-Leninist party. They've never broke with Stalin. In the PLA, People's Liberation Army Museum, there's a statue of Stalin. So I said, look, we have to understand that the Chinese state is run by a Communist Party that's Marxist-Leninist and Stalinist. And that's something they proclaim. That's not me attaching labels to them. That's just talking about their own ideology and their own doctrine.
Now, when I hear Stalinist Robert C. O'Brien, I think of Darkness at Noon. I think of the Gulag. I also think of the Uyghurs in the concentration camps in China. General Secretary Xi is ruthless. If he's anything, can President Trump do deals with him?
Well, President Trump's a pretty tough guy himself. And look, we certainly showed that we could do a deal with China on the phase one deal. But remember, that deal only came because President Trump did something that no other president has done in 40 years. He imposed significant tariffs on China. He imposed a cost on China for their unfair trade practices that they've engaged in for many, many years, taking upwards of $500 billion a year out of our economy, killing our manufacturing base in this country. And so President Trump put the sanctions on, or put the tariffs on, and as a result of the tariffs, we were able to get a deal. But there's, you know, this is not just about trade. I mean, this is about Chinese access to our capital markets. It's about the rampant theft of intellectual property. It's about China reaching out beyond its borders to try and silence Americans like they did with the general manager of the Houston Rockets who tweeted about Hong Kong. So the Chinese are active across all domains, and so we're taking very measured steps to deal with the Chinese and protect Americans.
Ambassador O'Brien, 6 months ago, America had the greatest economy it had ever enjoyed. We are now in a recession, though we're coming out of it. Does President Trump blame General Secretary Xi for what happened to our economy?
I don't think he blames Xi personally, but I think what he has said is that this plague, the COVID virus, the Wuhan pneumonia, as the Chinese used to label it before they went back and rewrote their history and rewrote their labels for the disease, this came from China. There was no cooperation from China early on. They didn't allow CDC doctors in. They still haven't given samples of the virus to us. They thwarted investigations into the origin and spread of the virus. And the virus came through the United States. It ripped through here. It killed over 120,000 Americans. It destroyed trillions of dollars in value. And so we've got, you know, there's a real problem with the Chinese right now. And I think every American recognizes that, not just President Trump.
Ought the news media to be trusting Chinese numbers about the extent and location of the coronavirus in the People's Republic of China today?
Well, let me ask you this. If a country expelled the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post from their country, if they censor every bit of information that shows up on their social media platforms like WeChat, if they attempt to censor people even overseas in free countries, can you trust them? I mean, that's the question. So that's a pretty easy answer. I think it's hard to trust anything that's coming out of official state organs in China at this point. Again, we call on the Chinese to open the doors on the origin and the spread of this virus. The Australians asked for a neutral international investigation into COVID, and instead of working with the Australians, their neighbor in the Pacific, the Chinese put 80% tariffs on barley to punish them for even calling for an independent investigation of what happened.
It has been nearly 2 weeks since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 6-3 to modify the meaning of sex in Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Associate Justice Gorsuch wrote the decision on behalf of the majority. In the Bostock decision, the court addressed the issue raised by three separate cases, including that of Harris Funeral Home versus the EEOC, with the funeral home being represented by the Alliance Defending Freedom. My colleague Larry Elder spoke with ADF Senior Counsel Kate Anderson.
We're going to talk about this so-called Bostock case that just now came down, 6-3. Please welcome to the program Senior Counsel, Alliance Defending Freedom, Kate Anderson, graduated from Gonzaga, where she served on the Gonzaga Law Review. Ms. Anderson, thank you very much for taking the time. This was really, really an unexpected 6-3 decision, wasn't it?
It was an unexpected decision, given the law that was at issue.
Given the law and the assumption that justices like Gorsuch and Roberts, when they were appointed, were going to be originalists and follow the text of the law. And now we have a 6-3 Supreme Court that, in my opinion, has gauged in the kind of legislating from the bench that all of us people that really believe in the Constitution have complained about.
Well, the issue before the court was whether in Title VII, which is the federal employment law, whether sex in that law includes sexual orientation and gender identity or not. And as you say, we would expect the justices to look to the original public meaning of that law at the time that it was passed in 1964. And there's little doubt that at that time, sex meant men and women. But as we saw, the court went the other way on that issue. Fortunately, the decision is narrow and narrow just to that particular law. And I think even within that employment law, there are a lot of questions still open.
Speaking of those questions, what does this mean for business owners? What does it mean for religious institutions?
A lot of that is still to be seen. The decision focused on terminating somebody simply for their gender identity or sexual orientation, independent of anything having to do with their actual ability to do the job, anything that would be a qualification for the job, other things like sex-specific dress code, bathroom use. A lot of these things were sort of left open, as well as how any of this could implicate other laws that deal with sex.
I'm talking with Kate Anderson, senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom. Kate Anderson, this could have been a pretty easy fix. If Congress had wanted to expand the definition of sex to include sexual orientation, they could have done that.
Yes, and actually this issue was before Congress on numerous occasions, and Congress has not added the concepts of sexual orientation or gender identity to this federal employment law. So Justice Alito, when he was writing his dissenting opinion in this case, he said that the court was legislating from the bench by making a change that Congress had declined to make, and there's definitely some truth in that.
I know that the ADF has been involved in representing female athletes who have been challenged by transgender male athletes. How does this decision affect all of that?
Well, we're certainly concerned about activists using the logic from this decision and trying to transport it outside of this context to move it into things like Title IX that protects women's equal opportunities in sports and in scholarship opportunities. The case you're talking about in Connecticut, we represent a couple of girls who, in that state, there are two male athletes who identify as female, who have taken 15 state track and field championship records over the last 3 years, and all of the opportunities that come with those. So there's definitely an issue before the courts on women's sports and the fairness for women to be able to compete and to be able to enjoy the equal opportunities, and particularly the scholarship opportunities that come from that.
Coming up.
The belief has been that a richer China would be a freer China. That was a mistaken assumption.
Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Robert Gates served as U.S. Secretary of Defense from 2006 to 2011, the only defense secretary to have served one president and then another of a different party. Secretary Gates has a new book out, Exercise of Power. The subtitle, American Failures, Successes, and a New Path Forward in a Post-Cold War World. The book covers the U.S.-China relationship over a multi-year period. It's an issue all Americans ought to be paying attention to. Secretary Gates joined me on The Hugh Hewitt Show. The end of this book, Exercise of Power, is all about China. It hasn't turned out how any of us expected, has it, Mr. Secretary?
Well, you know, Hugh, I make the point in the book, in the China chapter, that the first 20 years of the relationship really was quite geostrategic. There really wasn't a significant economic component to it. For Nixon and Kissinger, it was all about the relationship with Russia and how do you use China against Russia, and better to have a warm relationship with China to be able to exploit. And then the same was true with even Carter. Through about 1980 or so, it really was a geostrategic relationship where each saw it in its mutual advantage. Then with the advent of Deng Xiaoping's reforms and China's slow but accelerating growth, the economic component of the relationship really began to get underway in the 1980s and culminated early in the Clinton administration when we helped China get into the World Trade Organization. And then the economic relationship and China's economy both just exploded. So it really the last 40 years or so of the relationship have been when it's been dominated by the economy. And I would just make two additional points. I think particularly during the economic growth phase of this, from let's say in the 80s until until the current time, the belief has been that a richer China would be a freer China. That was a mistaken assumption. And then the second thing that we didn't anticipate was that a richer China would become a more assertive China.
Now, Mr. Secretary, for people who are, they can see how heavily annotated the book is. And one line is underscored, such high hopes. This was a bipartisan decision to buy into the China idea. Have both parties come to the recognition, in your view, and you are respected on both sides. I think you're the last man in America who actually has the respect of both party elites. Do both parties understand, in your view now, that the CCP is not our friend and they're not going to be our friend for a very long time?
I think so, Hugh. I think it's probably about the only thing you can point to these days where there's any kind of bipartisan agreement. And they're going to kind of have, I think that the two presidential candidates are going to have kind of dueling campaigns this fall about who's tougher on China.
Mr. Secretary, an exercise of power, you don't use the term Cold War 2.0. Is it appropriate to say we are in Cold War 2.0?
I think so. You know, we can dance around it and pretend that it's not going to be the same. I think actually in some ways it is potentially a little riskier in the sense that over time, we negotiated a number of arms control agreements and other kinds of assurances with the Soviets to make sure we avoided a military conflict. First, the arms control agreements that limited the number of nuclear weapons that we had. It basically codified what both sides wanted to do, but it provided predictability in the arms race. You know, you knew the other guy couldn't build more than X missiles or Y nuclear weapons. And we negotiated a lot of agreements to avoid incidents blowing up into major confrontations. So we negotiated the incidents at sea agreement with the Soviets. We negotiated how we would observe each other's military exercises and so on. We really don't have any of those agreements with China at all. So at this point, the relationship and the confrontations, particularly in the South China Sea, are kind of ungoverned space. And one of my minor achievements when I was secretary was getting a direct phone line put in between the Secretary of Defense and the Minister of Defense in China. And all I can say is that I think that if I were to ever use that line, there probably wouldn't be anybody at the other end of the phone. Because the Minister of Defense has relatively no power in China.
To hear my complete interview with Secretary Gates, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
If he loses, they're of no use to the left anymore.
Never Trumpers remain among us. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. One of the more sad and befuddling aspects of the Trump election is how it has bitterly divided conservatives, including some notable ones. One would have hoped and expected that the breach would be short-lived, but according to Julie Kelly of American Greatness, it has not been so. Ms. Kelly has just published a new book, Disloyal Opposition, How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President. My Salem colleague, Dennis Prager, invited Julie on his program to discuss.
I know 95% of the major never-Trumpers. I personally know them. And I have to tell you, it's painful. And some are beyond the pale. How do you explain them?
Well, Dennis, I think my voice, my book is intended to give a voice to what you just said about what you just said. And that's why I call it disloyal opposition. These are people, I don't know them personally like you do, but they're certainly people who I once respected, who I once trusted. This book really details how not only they betrayed people like us, the Republican Party, that was their gravy train for decades, but they really have pivoted on every position that they once had. You know, they're pro-climate change. They're pro, some of them now advocate abolishing the Second Amendment. They're pro-open border. So they're not even anything resembling conservative anymore. So this is their shtick, right? So they pretend that there is this dissent within the Republican Party or conservative movement, people who are on the right who oppose the president, which, of course, is not the case. And so this is how they make their living now. And I also detail in my book how a lot of them, including Bill Kristol, are funded, millions of dollars in funding, by a left-wing tech billionaire. So Piero Mittiar is a is the founder of eBay. He is a virulent anti-Trumper. He formulated a Never Trump PAC in 2016. But he's a left-winger, so he's in the same group as most tech billionaires. They're very leftist, and they want to quell conservative voices. He has donated millions of dollars to these new nonprofits that you see popping up. So I go through all the list of Never Trumpers who the Bulwark is one of the projects. The Bulwark is kind of the offshoot of the Weekly Standard. After the Weekly Standard was shuttered the end of 2018, the Bulwark was formed. So you know who these people are, Charlie Sykes, Jim Swift, the kind of Weekly Standard rejects went to the Bulwark. They are receiving money from Piero Mittiar as well. So it's not even that these so-called Never Trump conservatives are funded by disgruntled conservatives. They are funded by leftists so they can portray that there's a conservative discontent with Donald Trump when it really doesn't exist.
You know more about this than I do, so this is a real education for me. How many people read The Bulwark?
That is a good question. I would, you know, they play this role as a foil. So they are retweeted by people like Jake Tapper. They're retweeted at people by at The Atlantic and Politico. So they really play also, one of the chapters in my book is entitled Useful Idiot. They are the useful idiot for the left. Now, what'll be interesting, Dennis, is what their usefulness is in the next Trump era, whether Trump wins or loses. If he loses, they're of no use to the left anymore. And you already see some of the leftists and the Democrats say, well, we'll use you to the extent that it helps our narrative, but we don't want your input in any Democratic administration or any Democratic power structure. You're only to stay here, write your columns, go on MSNBC and CNN, and spew this Trump hate, pretending that it comes from Republicans. You know, and we already see, Dennis, some of these new groups are popping up again, Republicans for Joe Biden. There was another PAC that was formulated by Anthony Scarlucci. So they're trying the same thing that they played in 2016, 2018, and they're re-upping it for 2020.
Who was Bill Kristol's right hand at the Weekly Standard? What was his name again?
Stephen Hayes.
No, that's true. He was his right hand. Then I'm thinking of sort of the co-editor. Fred Barnes. Fred Barnes.
Okay.
Yeah. What happened to Fred Barnes?
I don't know where Fred Barnes is. I don't discuss him in my book. But Stephen Hayes, as you know, went with Jonah Goldberg. And Jonah Goldberg left National Review. Stephen Hayes, they formed this new newsletter, really, is what it is, called The Dispatch.
And who's funding that?
I'm not sure. We're trying to find out who's funding that, but you have to subscribe to the Dispatch. So you can't get their newsletter content without subscribing to it. So that's that's partially where they're getting their money. But David French, who left National Review, he is with the Dispatch also. And they are really, I think, in a way, even more disappointing, because I know there are a lot of your listeners who follow Jonah Goldberg, you know, bought his books, trusted him as a true conservative. And all he does, if he's on Fox News or writes from the Dispatch, they blast not just the president, but Republicans who support the president, Republican lawmakers, governors, and, of course, Trump supporters in a really demeaning way.
Julie, I spent a lot of my time thinking about a question, and the question is always, why? I've told my listeners that if I were on a sinking ship, I wouldn't ask where the lifeboats were first. I'd ask, why are we sinking? Which is not a compliment to me. That's just how my mind works. I need to understand, and then I could live with what I understand. To this moment, I am the never Trumpers that you mentioned, I find hard to explain. And when I have talked to them, in fact, Brett Stephens and I have had a public day. He wrote a column about me in the Times. I wrote a column about him in my syndicated column. It was both respectful, and the only thing I could conclude to this day is that the biggest single difference between us is that I perceive the left as a mortal threat to the country, and they do not.
I think that that's absolutely true. And I think, Dennis, in a way, we could see that playing out just over the last few weeks.
For the complete conversation of Dennis Prager and Julie Kelly, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
I believe the legacy and the ancestry of Black Americans is being insulted every single day. I will not pretend to be a victim in this country. I know that that makes many people on the left uncomfortable.
A new documentary with the provocative title Uncle Tom by my friend Larry Elder, himself an African-American who has been called that very term. In the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, the Supreme Court goes back to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
If sex is no longer tied to biology, that is a seismic shift in our society.
Conservatives and originalists were more than a little disappointed.
Justice Gorsuch, meet Justice Gorsuch.
And amidst the times of unrest, hear from Larry Elder about his new film, Uncle Tom.
If we had a vaccine to get rid of anti-Black racism, let's say every bit of it is purged for every heart of America, are the principal problems facing the Black community still there? Will 70% of Black kids still be raised without fathers?
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. One might think that recent events have heightened the divide between African Americans and conservatives. In fact, conservatives are a diverse group with a real and growing cultural and racial diversity. African American conservatives are growing in number. They are also increasingly vocal and bold, in spite of the risk of being labeled an Uncle Tom, a vicious slur that endures year after year, decade after decade. Here's my colleague Mike Gallagher with another colleague, Larry Elder, himself an African American, talking about Larry's new film project by that same provocative name, Uncle Tom.
I believe the legacy and the ancestry of Black Americans is being insulted every single day. I will not pretend to be a victim in this country. I know that that makes many people on the left uncomfortable.
I want to dig down to two of the things that I found most powerful about the movie. Number one, the way you open and close the movie with a plumber, a guy who's living the American dream. He doesn't have a big platform like we have. He loves this country, and he, like many, had an amazing, really a sea change in the way he viewed things.
Well, and that's right, and he's relatable. He's not in your face. He's not a politician. He's not trying to change your mind. He's trying to open your eyes. And his journey is that he has became a born-again Christian, but he still was a Democrat. And another Christian asked him why he was a Democrat, and his response, well, the Democrats care about the poor. And doesn't the Bible tell you to care about the poor? And his friend said, does the Bible talk about government caring about the poor? or about you caring about the poor? And the friend challenged him to read the Republican and the Democrat platform, and Chad, the plumber, took him up on it and read both platforms. After he finished, he said, I'm a Republican. And it's about the grief that he got, including from his own mom, because of his conversion. Rather than these people generating a healthy conversation about whether we ought to be in the party of porous borders, when studies show that illegal aliens who are unskilled compete for jobs that would otherwise be held by black and brown unskilled workers in the inner city and puts pressure on their wages, should we be in that party? Should we be in the party that opposes school choice when my high school, only 3% of kids can do math at grade level, and by the way, it's dominated by the Crips gang? Now, suppose you're a parent living in that geographical radius. You are mandated to send your kid to a school where only 3% of the kids can do math at grade level and is run by the Crips. But the Republicans want to give you option out, and I'm pulling the lever for the party that tells me and my kid you're going to this school whether you like it or not. Maybe, just maybe, we ought to have a healthy conversation about whether it makes sense for 95% of blacks to pull the lever for the Democratic Party. And instead of people like myself, Carson, others raising these issues and people saying, they've got a point, maybe we ought to reconsider this, we're Uncle Tom, we're self-loathers, we don't like our own people. This is just an immaturity that is hurting things. And if you notice the film, at least I hope so, it's not angry. I'm not mad at the people for calling us these names. I pity their inability to open their minds and see that their very obtuseness is making things worse.
Learn more about that provocative documentary by Larry Elder, Uncle Tom, at uncletom.com. Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brinkman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.